Ada. Heute das Morgen verstehen.
Today we would like to discuss how our human condition, our coexistence with each other, has been shaped in the last couple of years by monumental shifts. We have lived through two global economic crises. There is climate change that is a global challenge to address. We live through an age of intense polarization. Inequalities are increasing. And of course, we've all lived through a major pandemic recently. And today we want to ask the question, what kinds of steps of self-reflection does it take for us as individuals and as organizations and even as society to actually address all those really profound and monumental changes? And for this discussion, we're really thrilled to be joined by three experts today in the fields of psychology and human relations, of mindful leadership and social justice, and of communication and technology. Esther Perel, Angel Acosta, and Miriam Meckel, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed.
So, Esther, I just listed all of these giant shifts and changes that we've been going through. Do you actually think that we do live in times of really unprecedented sweeping change, or is that maybe also an illusion that every generation has?
The latter. I do think that we live in a time of unprecedented change, but it's not the first time that it's happening. So that many generations have felt that this is the world that they're living in is not the world that they once knew, and that the assumptions with which they regulated their lives are being questioned or sometimes even shattered. I don't know that I think one thing, whenever we ask that question, there is invariably somebody who says, but never has the planet been at such risk. Never have we faced the kind of self-destruction of humanity in the way that today, you know, it could all one day disappear. And I think that is the fundamental question. Everything else we have had, wars, disasters, natural disasters, pandemics, we've had all of that, but we've never felt that we have reached a place by which we could annihilate ourselves to that extent.
Wow, annihilation, that's a sort of level of threat. Angel, do you think it's also about the pace of all of these changes, that it's just really increased and we feel like we can't keep up?
Yeah, you know, I think the byproducts of the Industrial Revolution and the information technology revolution over the last 20 years has impacted incredibly how we engage in just our relationship building, our business management. But I think that there is this incredibly powerful moment for us to think about how we want to move forward. And part of what I want to do is slow us down. So yes, the pace of change has increased, and
yes,
my central work is to slow us down, even in this conversation. Slowing us down, it's good to see you. It's a pleasure to see you. It's so good to see you.
Good to see you.
And, but I do think that the concentrated impact of the last 400 years, looking at the connection between colonization and imperialism, the evolution of capitalism at the state, has impacted how we are relating to the planet to the point of possible annihilation. I draw here on indigenous wisdom that right now we're called to be in right relationship, in right relationship to ourselves, in right relationship to each other, and in right relationship to Mother Earth. So yes, there has been an increase in change, and I think there needs to be an increase in the pace of us slowing down and relating to those particular levels of self, other, and planet.
So taking the idea of slowing down, which I love and I will try to do in my speaking as well. Miriam, is that something leaders can do nowadays? Are they allowed to be slow? And are they allowed to acknowledge that speed is maybe not the right way to go?
Well, I think they better be able to deal with becoming slower, because if you just rush through transformation and change, I think you will lose the people. You somehow have to be a role model in figuring out how to find the balance between admitting the uncertainty of the respective situation where things are really changing, and still being also a role model for offering solutions and offering ways of connecting to your teams, to your people. And I think you can't do that in a rush. So whenever you, as a leader, have to to figure out how to take your team and do a step-by-step journey through a transformation process, then you really need to communicate a lot. You have to do it in a slow way, because otherwise you lose the people. And you have to offer a balance between security and solution, because that's why you're a leader. And on the other hand, insecurity or uncertainty, to allow for people to come up with doubts, to be transparent about their fears, being scared, and things like that. And that's a huge challenge, I think. Mm-hmm. But that's a way a leader of today should be able to deal with the situation.
Mm-hmm. You've often talked about the challenge of leaning into ambiguity, right? And sort of leaning into almost like the gray zone of not knowing, of uncertainty. Why is that so hard for us?
So interesting. I'm listening to Miriam and I'm thinking every living organism, every society, every couple, every living organism in nature straddles stability and change. And this is actually not new, you know. If you don't change, you fossilize and you die. If you change too fast and too much, you dysregulate and you go into chaos. So this negotiation, this balancing act is always, always present. And in between that, what happens is that I think when there is uncertainty, it's uncertainty in a couple, in a family, in a society, the tendency is to fragment and to polarize. So that, you know, should we move or should we stay? Should we have children? Should we not? Should we expand or should we stay put? Should we invest or should we do with what we have? These kind of polarities for which there is no set answer. The typical thing in the face of uncertainty is that I take one part of the equation and then others take the other part of the equation. This is the polarization that you see in the society as well. And then I become the manifester, the holder of this position, and the other side takes the other half of the position, when in fact each person actually lives with both sides inside of them. That's the ambiguity. It's holding the ambivalence. It's holding the fact that this and this, this is a choice, this is a choice, this has consequences, and so forth. Typically what we do is we split the ambivalence, we fragment, we polarize, and then we can antagonize. And everyone in that antagonism presents themselves as if they're sure of their position, when in fact it is their anxiety that produces a false certainty.
I think that actually has to do with technology also in a way, because I just, when I listened to you, I thought computer science has brought binary thinking, and that is exactly what you just described. You have digital thinking, you have zero or one, you have good or bad, you have black or white. And this turns into a huge difficulty to deal with the ambiguity, because somehow you think it must be one or the other, because that's how we process data these days. And that's basically a difference between the computer.
It's a different kind of knowledge.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Data knowledge is binary knowledge. It is, and it believes in data as the only form of knowledge. Mm. There is intuition, there is wisdom tradition, there's lots of other forms of knowledge that are not included, and those are knowledges that hold much more nuance and ambiguity. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So could there be room for a completely new kind of connection if we really lean into that ambiguity in a sort of, you know, if leaders embraced ambiguity, really leaned in?
Yeah, for sure. You know, just going back to the point that Miriam made about slowing down, that slowing down really, it's not about a function of speed, but rather awareness. Mm-hmm. And this comes from Dr. Bayo Komolafe. That it's not us slowing down as a sloth, but rather that the ways in which that I'm engaging in this conversation, I'm attuned to the relational field. Mm-hmm. I'm slowing down enough to be able to make those sophisticated decisions, whether it's in a corporate space or in a school. And I think that lends to holding space for the nuance. Mm-hmm. If I can slow down enough where I can see the multiple dimensions of a given moment, then I can deal with, you know, whether it's paradox, you know, holding the binary and knowing that it's not a binary, it's actually a more dynamic thing. So, and in fact, in some of the last 10 years of research on workforce readiness, there was this obsession on what are the skills for the 21st century, and, you know, teamwork, critical thinking, pro-social skills, you know, forgiveness, collaboration. On the lower end of that list was conflict resolution and paradoxical thinking. And I think we need to bump those up. Mm. I think we need to bump those up in terms of dealing with emergence, uncertainty. And the last thing I'll say is composting. And again, Dr. Bayo Komolafe talks about this idea of approaching our lives as composting. Mm. What would it mean for us to engage in a kind of composting-like thinking with whatever situation, just letting it sit, let it marinate, let it, the chemical reaction of the moment.
Reading.
You know, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So thank you, Bayo.
Gardening metaphor, I like it. I want to pick up the word of paradoxical thinking, actually, and we've talked about ambiguity, paradoxes, and you mentioned that we actually hold this within ourselves, right? And I'm guessing that ambiguity about yourself also means that there might be some parts that we feel uncomfortable with or that we don't like as much. So I'd love to do a quick lightning round with all of you. Please complete the sentence, I am most judgmental when it comes to what? Mm. Miriam.
Oh my God, I feared I had to start. I relate that to the question of being fast and slow, because I, in spite of the fact that I'm trying to be really aware of that, I sometimes feel that I'm impatient with people when they're very slow, be it in decision making, be it in really getting things done, in talking sometimes even. And I feel that I get impatient, and that's kind of a way of being judgmental, and I really don't like that about myself.
Angel?
I think I'm most judgmental when observing responses to anxiety. You know, as a mindfulness practitioner, and the illusion I have is that I have this relationship with my interior landscape, and I can be this distant to external stimuli. So sometimes when I see folks just, you know, losing their cool, I can be judgmental. But the reality is that I lose my cool too all the time, you know? So I think I'm most judgmental in witnessing responses to anxiety, especially ones that are not merited or a little extreme.
Can you relate to that as a therapist, maybe? When are you most judgmental?
It came right up for me. I'm most judgmental of people who think they're right. And who think that there is one answer, one solution, and who refuse to consider options, to hold the doubt, to hold the ambiguity. I think faced with the kinds of questions that you were asking at first, so many of these things don't have just a pat answer. I think sometimes that the data-driven approach has that notion of it's evidence-based, you know? And there are so many other... What about a perspective that is actually people-based rather than evidence-based? So it's that. It's that kind of rigidity. And of course, I can become as rigid about my judgment as the thing that I'm judging, let's be clear. It's like you know, I lose my cool too.
Well, and the data-driven approach also pretends to be objective, right? Very sort of, this is sort of like rationality and objectivity.
I deal with relationships, you know, and one of the first things I say when you talk about conflict and relationships, I say to the people, I said, this thing you just said that you present as a fact is actually an experience. It is pseudo-factual. You think it's objective, but really it is your subjective experience, and it's that which you want these people or this partner or this team or this manager to be able to relate to. But you don't need to pretend that it is objective fact. It isn't.
Yes, there's an interesting approach by Gregory Bateson, the anthropologist, who once said that information is a difference that makes a difference. So basically applied to the data-driven world, that means we think that there is data and there is information we get out of the data. But as you just said, that's just not true, because every information just comes into life by the experience we are having with it. So the difference of information makes for me, for example, is a total different one than it makes for you, it makes for you, it makes for you. So that means basically the binary thinking or the understanding that I am right and you are wrong just can't happen. It's always about our cognition, our feelings, our perception of things. And I have the feeling that this has become much more difficult in a technologically driven world, or in a data-driven world, to accept that it's always transformed by experience.
Why?
Because of what Leah said.
It's a different relationship to truth, so why?
It is, because we think if we can put something into data, that must be truth, because it's factual, and I think that's not. That's not true, to stay with that. And we have to relearn in a way that a very subjective view of the world is still happening, and it's still basically the fundamental experience of our world. And it's different what my subjective view of the world is than what your subjective view is. And it's a question of respect and tolerance to accept that, first of all. But I think we are unlearning that by technology in a way.
Because we are pursuing a rational approach?
Very much so. A data-driven approach, a binary approach. And that makes it hard to accept diversity, ambiguity.
So, Angel, at the beginning you also mentioned, you brought in indigenous wisdom. You said, you talked a lot about reconnecting, to be able to break up these sort of insecurities and the fears of all these changes that we're going through. And I wonder, to stay on that topic of reconnecting with ourselves, with each other, you talk a lot about reconnecting with our bodies as well, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, you just mentioned it was very rational, very cognitive. Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say actually reconnecting with our bodies?
Yeah. I just want to, Esther said earlier, she said holding doubt. Mm-hmm. And there's something there about holding, and as far as a upskilling, a skill that we need to develop. Like, how do you hold paradox? How do you hold doubt? How do you hold conflict? And part of the holding is a somatic phenomenon. Like, how do I feel in this moment? Like, being in this space, responding to you, not just at an intellectual level, but from a heart space. So the somatic involves, obviously, the body sensing into, and I think this helps with slow work and leading in spaces, right? So there's a situation that you're handling, and you can get overwhelmed from a cognitive space and a cognitive place, thinking about all the different decisions that you need to make. But your body's an incredible process and entity, so allowing its entire being to help you in decision making, not just your mind, but your heart even. You can, you know, the idea of thinking from your feet is a thing. You know, thinking with your whole body, a quickness, a cleverness to respond to nature and world, the life's unpredictable nature, you know. So that's what I'll say. And I'll just say something about rational thinking in terms of Esther, she brought that up. And there's something about rational thinking that closes the world. It creates an illusion of the world being static, but the world is so much more fluid and dynamic. How dare you? Try to box it in such a way, and it's helped us as a society to engage in scientific empiricism. It's allowed us to, you know, categorize the animal world. It's allowed us to categorize the natural world, but it's cornered us into an extractive relationship with nature. So that's what I think that rational thought does sometimes. So it's time for just a little bit more mixing it up a little bit. You know, Esther talks about mixing it up in relationships. I think it's the same thing at a larger level with the planet.
Well, and you also talk about being playful, right? That's sort of what you're alluding to, Derek.
Yeah.
You talk a lot about playfulness, Esther, in terms of actually when it comes to intimacy, when it comes to any kind of connection. I feel like that's a term that's really hard for adults to actually, first of all, to do, to be playful, or rather to be, I should say. And maybe it sounds like that is somehow child-related.
Yes.
How can adults be playful? What do you actually mean by that?
It's a beautiful question. I mean, the idea, yes, is that children are allowed to play. Play being the ground for experimentation, for solutions, for trying out solutions, for creativity, for imagination. And the notion is that for adults, when they play, it's not serious. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it clashes very much with the world of work. Work versus play. Mm-hmm. The fact that work is playful, that play, the creativity, the options, the trying things out, the exploratory nature and all of that, the curiosity that comes with play, the active engagement with the unknown that comes with play, the permission for taking risks that comes with play. I mean, I spent a year creating a game, and I was all reading about play theories and what is play and why are we so holding against it. And at the same time, we know that playfulness defined in that way is essential to innovation. It's essential to coming up with ways that people never considered it because you try it out for size. And play offers a container. It has the word play that says you won't be held accountable for it because you're playing. But while you're playing, you can try all kinds of things that you wouldn't dare do in real life, kind of thing, right? I think that especially after a year and a half of being still, of just seeing bodies that are static, you barely see them breathe, you never see them move. I mean, we, you know, forget touch, that is also a major somatic experience. You know, the mixing it up, idea is highly needed in this moment. You know, part of why we enjoy being here together at the table again is because we see each other move. We actually see each other breathe. We see that creates a very different experience. We actually make eye contact. We're not just looking at each other, but in fact, no mirror neurons are being fired here. All of this is somatic. All of this involves energy. All of this, therefore, is playful. And all of this, therefore, can create for very serious business.
Well, you said serious business, right? Is that possible at work? You mentioned at the beginning that's really hard because it seems to be a
working country. Right now.
Yeah,
good, you know, okay, this good is, point. We are all here all at work. True. You are working here. We're all here at work. We are doing something. We're creating a conversation. We hope that it will stimulate the people that are listening to it. It is a serious conversation. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I'm relaxed, I'm breathing, I'm smiling, I'm connecting, I don't feel alone, I feel that somebody's listening to me, I'm resonating to what other people are saying, and all of this relational intelligence is serious business.
And Esther said permission. You know, at some levels, we're giving ourselves permission. Like, I gave myself permission to do slow work and be slow in this conversation. And part of that permission is also to play. And one thing that to frame what Esther said around play and creativity and experimentation is that it facilitates the opportunity to experience awe. Like I'm experiencing awe right now of just the brilliance in this conversation. And so in terms of, you know, serious business, it's really about giving yourself permission to one play and to create the container for experimentation, for innovation, for awe. And then obviously you get into the conversation around profit when it comes to business. And so that's where I think where it gets a little serious. It's like, okay, if we play too much, will this impact the bottom line? Well, in some cases it will.
Maybe even positively.
And even if it impacts the bottom line negatively in terms of that number, if you juxtapose that to the social fabric of the container or the people that you're leading, I'm sure that will be net positive. Mm-hmm. So that trade-off there is going to be interesting for leaders to make.
I was just wondering, we might be able to help the members of the ancient corporate world to accept playfulness if we rephrase it. So what you were describing is a little bit maybe like an experimental mode also, and children accept that as a given. They just try out things all the time. And if we talk about experimental mode, that works well. You can do that in boardrooms and people don't freak out and leave. If you talk about playfulness, I know some boardrooms where this will become very, very difficult. Also, an entrepreneur is always someone who is in a way playful because he or she has to try out things. And of course that has to do with playfulness, but we don't call it that because then everyone thinks he or she is supposed to be childish, which is of course not the case. So maybe rephrasing it sometimes help to carry people across some gaps they think they just can't overcome.
But when you rephrase, you opt for one approach. When you take the old language and you infuse it with new meaning, you are actually in a more innovative territory.
I'm with you.
You understand? I purposefully want to call it playfulness. I purposefully talk about eros, in the workplace, mm-hmm. as in aliveness, vibrancy, vitality, curiosity, energy, not the sexual meaning of it, mm-hmm. because everyone understands coming to work and feeling deadened, mm-hmm. and coming to work and feeling energized and alive, and you know, here we are sitting like this, that is somatic. I'm leaning, I'm listening, I'm paying attention, I'm alert, you know. That is a very different way of being at work. This is all somatic. I don't have to say a word. I can be in a meeting like this, and we will have one particular kind of conversation, and I can be in a meeting like this, and we're having a different conversation. And I think that if you use words that are less challenging, you actually leave people in their comfort zone. If you want them to stretch beyond their comfort zone, you take a language and you say, this is how we typically look at it. It's like stoicism. We typically look at it as grinning and bearing and hardness. It has nothing to do with the original meaning of stoicism. You know, virtue and vulnerability. It's a combination, self and community. Everybody is talking about that, that mix at this point. Security, as you were saying earlier, you know. And my job, anyway, is to infuse that new meaning in the language that exists rather than making it comfortable.
Yeah. I like that thought. And it's also maybe some sort of provocation then, which children also do a lot.
Yes.
They, all the time they are provocative towards their parents to figure out how far can I go. And so maybe that's, I like that approach.
Otherwise you maintain status quo. So if a couple comes to me, if a family comes to me, if co-founders, if a company, I think that you want to balance, but you definitely want to help people stretch beyond.
So to recap for all the leaders or the people in leadership positions who are listening and are terrified right now after the first 20 minutes, they need to be more vulnerable, they need to be okay with uncertainty, they need to reconnect to their bodies, they need to be slower, they need to be playful. This is a huge change, I think, for many people.
Yes, they will basically create a dual language between productivity and compassion, or between profit and meaning, or purpose. I mean, there is a sense of a lot of dualities at this moment that we are trying to reconcile in the world of work, corporate or other. And bottom line may be sometimes profit, but bottom line sometimes may be purpose. At this moment, there is an entire generation coming into the workforce that wants more than just a fat paycheck, or even a small paycheck that pays the bills. They want a sense of belonging, of community, of identity, of personal growth. That is a very new meaning of work. Stuff that people used to look for in other areas of life, in communal life, in religious life, is now coming to work. If you're a CEO, you really, and you are dealing with retention, which many are doing at this moment, of any kind of company, then you need to understand why people are staying and why people are leaving. And that's why these things, I don't need the CEO to think that you have to be all of those things, but you really, I think, need to know, what does work mean today? It's like, you know, when I talk about marriage, I talk about what is the new meaning of marriage? What do people look for in marriage, in committed relationships, in intimate relations? It's not the same as it was 50 years ago. Neither is it at work. Is that okay to say?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Very clear. Well, and all of you actually have alluded, you've mentioned multiple times we're here together. We are physically here. We are actually able to connect. And I think that's a question also of what it has been feeling like, especially in the last 18 months, to have any kind of community, right? Was that even possible to feel community through, for example, technology? A lot of us, you mentioned it was only this part of the body, but a lot of us at least had those video calls. And I wonder if we can sort of take a look at what technology has done to our sense of community first. So,
huge.
I mean, for example, lots of movements, right, where we've seen things go viral, climate marches, police brutality, lots of things that maybe without those kinds of technologies would not have been possible. So Can you talk a little bit, Angel, about what, where you see the role of technology in finding maybe a new way of community? And this is not just happening in the last 18 months, of course, but it has been this new platform for sparking community.
As I was preparing for this conversation, I was thinking about Esther's work in terms of mating in captivity. Because on some levels, this last year and a half, we've been working in captivity or working in a form of capture.
Mating in captivity, the quarantine.
You know? Really, right? Right? You know, so I just find resonance there with your work in terms of this moment and what does it mean to work in a kind of captivity and capture or be in a relationship. Like, I haven't seen my grandmother in 3 months and she's 95 years old and I love her to pieces. So I think, so on the one hand, it's been difficult and I just want to take a moment to touch the grief that comes with the loss of a previous life and the routines, the patterns that we had and the loss of life. So anybody who's lost anybody, just sending you condolences. But at the same time, I've seen an incredible upsurge in intentional communities online. So on the one hand, this moment creates a lot of isolation for many, but I've been in spaces with people from all over the world who have been able to come together and talk specifically about issues of racial equity, structural inequality. And where I'm at now is like, oh my God, in the midst of the depressing moment of being isolated, what does it mean to engage in a kind of structural love in digital form? So there is potential, and there is. I'm very optimistic in a stoic way, and just excited. but Miriam has a lot to say about this as an expert in technology and communications.
Well, I think we really have observed the dual nature of technology. On the one hand side, it has brought many very positive things. You mentioned a few, Angel. On the other hand side, I really think we also can observe that technology can take us apart as individuals, like sitting in front of a Zoom call or whatever video call for 12 hours a day makes you extremely tired in a different way, as I observed it myself, than being in a conference space or being around other people. It makes you drained because you don't have, like you said before, Esther, you don't have the real eye contact. You're staring into a camera for hours and you don't feel the other people. And that is something that can be helpful once in a while, but we can't make it the new default setting of being in conversation. And also, I think we see that the whole issue of polarization we discussed before in society has really been triggered by technologies in many ways. So technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral, like Malvin Kranzberg once said, because whenever we use it, we load it with social meaning and psychological meaning for ourselves, for other people as well. And that's something that we really could observe during the pandemic, I think, more than before.
Well, since you have brought up polarization in terms of technology, we also see certain very deeply held beliefs being pushed into a corner and amplified, right? Research shows that we're incredibly polarized, maybe even because of, or at least helped by filter bubbles. We have a technological way to present media in a way that is completely unfactual, deep fake media. We have all of these kind of recent advances in technology that have, I perceive, completely changed our relation to truth, our relation to what opinions matter and how we feel about differing opinions. Do you see that as sort of a change for the worse in terms of communication? Because it's really kind of stark.
Well, at least I see it as a real challenge for communities, because if the belief systems for different parts of our lives just breaks apart in that way we discussed before, like in a binary way or in a confrontational way, then it's really hard to get into a conversation. If people say, I'm right and you're wrong all the time, you're not communicating. You're basically insisting upon your own position. And What comes to my mind is the example of the hugely discussed Theranos case, because the idea of doability is an idea that is really brought into a society and strengthened in society by technology. We can do it, we can rely on data, we can make it happen. And that's also related to the belief in Silicon Valley, fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. And if you see that example, that over the course of years, you can build up a billion-dollar company without having one real thing that works. And doing it and applying it to sick people, that should make us rethink how we want to use technology and whether the basic framework of thinking how technology will change our life is one we want to really adopt for ourselves, and I think we shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Just to give some context maybe for the viewers who don't know the Theranos case, this is the company Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes, the CEO, who basically promised for about 10 years that she was able to do a bunch of blood tests, 200 actually, with the prick of one drop of blood, and this was basically never technically possible. She's now in front of a court for many major fraud charges, and it's basically brought up all of these questions of what do we promise technology to be versus what is actually possible, and don't we have this totally overblown view also of what technology can do? So since I want to stay a little bit on the issue of polarization, because you brought it up at the very beginning, we also tend to, in our very human ways, very much go into our corner of our opinion. And I want to do another lightning round, because I actually find it hard to consider this question for myself. And I would like to put it to all three of you. When was a time that you have actually changed your mind? Can you share?
I'm not going to be starting this time.
One issue. When you've actually genuinely changed your mind. Mm. Angel, do you want to start?
Probably yesterday. I think, after going through a rigorous doctoral program at Columbia, that five-year period, I think my perspective on how we should educate our children has changed very dramatically. I think in the spirit of thinking that we're right, we all have opinions on how we should educate children or kids, and I think I had a similar orientation that that certain conditions would enable powerful learning. And I think throughout my doctoral experience, I noticed that there's so much at play when it comes to educating young people, the structural forces, the historical forces, the social conditions, trauma, the impact of trauma, the fact that our kids are not just their trauma, they're incredibly complicated and complex beings, and thinking about how to create conditions for aliveness. And I think Esther mentioned that earlier. And I'll just take this opportunity to talk about thriving a little bit. There's a lot of research on thriving right now, and thinking about thriving in the workplace. And just for those who are listening, one of my colleagues, Dr. Kia Darling-Hammond, PhD from Stanford, she did studies on thriving, and she said that there are five particular elements that need to be put in place for any community to thrive. One, a sense of community, like a sense that there is this shared identity, or at least a shared sense of a common purpose or destination, so community. Two, selfhood, that in that community, you can be who you are fully and express that, and be seen and acknowledged by that community. Thirdly, pleasure. So it has to be fun, right? Can we play? Can we experiment? And let's use the language of play. Thirdly, abundance. So can you feel a sense of abundance? Not just monetarily, right? But just a sense of enough. There's enough in this. Like I feel abundant, a sense of abundance in this space. And then lastly, there's a composite element, and that's just being. So can you create the conditions where people can just be?
It's so interesting that the two major areas of research at this moment are thriving and trauma. Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And these two are related, mm-hmm. right? It's like the research on wellness, feeling good, being on a communal, collective level and on an individual level, and then trauma as the permissive licensed language for talking about pain and suffering today. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
Fascinating. And then in terms of work, because we're talking to communities who are in business, in the middle there is peak performance. Mm-hmm. So peak performance for, you know, for business, for whatever organization you're in. And in between trauma and flourishing, in the context of trying to create conditions for peak performance, there's flow. So in what ways are you creating conditions for your colleagues, for your teammates to experience a sense of flow? And part of, there's so many different features of flow we can get into. I'll just name one. That time tends to dilate. Like time, like I don't know how long we've been in this conversation right now. I feel like it's been a while, but maybe it's just been half an hour. I don't know. So I've been in a state of flow. And as I said earlier, I experienced awe. So in a sense, I'm in a state of peak performance, at least in terms of me feeling comfortable being here and just being graced by just beauty at the most fundamental level in terms of being in relational, expressing my relational intelligence with you all.
Well, I'm so glad you changed your mind on that, because that was really interesting. I don't know what you thought before, but I really like it.
I had two thoughts about changing the mind. And before that, I was really thinking when you were talking about polarization. I'm a couples therapist primarily, mm-hmm. and so I think I've lived in the land of polarization, you know, for a long time. I think that in a micro way, couples therapy presents you with polarized relationships mm-hmm. of people who need each other badly. Mm. So we can go into that, but I just thought, I have experience with polarization, but from a different... I had two immediate responses that popped into my head when you asked me about changing my mind, and I'll start with the more recent one. I think I fundamentally changed my mind in terms of racism in the last year. I definitely had this notion that to be a racist is to harbor negative thoughts, discriminatory thoughts about another group or other people, rather than to be a racist is also participating in a system that structurally privileges certain people toward others. That it's not just about not liking certain people and what you think about them, that it's much more systemic and structural than just thoughts and feelings and prejudices. And that definitely created a very different worldview for me in relation to the subject of racism, and of which I am myself a product of, you know. Belgium, Polish, Jewish, Holocaust survivor, parents. I mean, I definitely have never thought of myself just coming from easy and privileged. But that notion of the structural really made a difference for me. And the other place where I think I changed my mind was that until 5 years ago, I definitely worked within a clinical, academic, professional context. I didn't know how do you take these things from the consultation room into the public square, and the importance of taking private drama into public spaces and maintaining the complexity but making it accessible and affordable for all. You know, to do a podcast where I record live therapy sessions, that was, you know, but they're not my patients, but they still is the same process. And to bring this out, something that, you know, my work is secret. We don't talk about what we do. And so to make it suddenly available for free to the world and to say, this is therapeutic, this is not therapy, but there's plenty to learn in this, was a fundamental change after 35 years of what does one do with that knowledge that one accumulates in a clinical room. So where should we begin? How's work? I mean, this was really for me, like, at first I thought I'm betraying, I'm losing the essence, I sell my soul to the, you know, and then I actually really thought of it like I and I still think that somebody's going to come and say, you sold your soul to the devil. You know,
Faust is...
No, I'm really happy that you changed your mind on that. And, and you decided to do the podcast.
It's very hard.
It's very hard,
you know, to...
But you probably helped a lot of people.
It might even add to our conversation about technology.
Absolutely, it's also a way.
That's an educational technology.
It's a social technology that's interestingly collective, and I think also very individual, because a podcast can be so intimate. Even if you listen maybe with two people, you listen to it together. I've definitely done that, and it sparks conversation. It's really insightful. Miriam, have you changed your mind?
Well, I think yes, very often. The thing that came to my mind immediately is that whenever you end a relationship, you change your mind, but not in the, not only in the very concrete way, but like your mind changes. That's at least my experience. Maybe even your whole personality changes in a way. So that came to my mind, but I don't want to go deeper in that. The other thing that came to my mind, where it really changed my mind, also in a dual way, is I think up to the age of like 40, I thought that my brain is basically the commander in chief. So that's my steering committee, and it allows for my body, allows my body to do everything I want. So basically, if my brain says yes, you can do that, then I will do it. And that basically caused me to run into a major depression about 10 years ago. And I really went very deep into that topic, the connection of the human brain and the human body and the soul and whatever goes together there.
And the heart.
And the heart, yes, of course. Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on whether you want to mention it as a heart or as a soul. I think that you could we could debate that, but all of it. So it has to be seen as one. So it's just a needs to be a holistic approach. And so I got rid of this commander-in-chief, my brain as a commander-in-chief idea, and that was very healing. It was really a deep change, and I really like that I could make this transformation, because I think it changed me as a personality in many ways.
Well, we're all, you just mentioned it's been a long time, actually, that we've been in this conversation. It has been a wonderful flow, so to end, I'd just like to do two more things. Number one, I want us to think about rituals, because I think rituals, especially in times of isolation, are an interesting way to connect. And I want to bring in the wonderful author Suleika Jawad, because she recently wrote about the power of rituals. They are, and I quote, "ceremonies that allow us to shoulder complicated feelings, that make room for the seemingly paradoxical act of acknowledging the past as a path toward the future." So I want to take that idea of these ceremonies and wonder what kinds of rituals could help us in this moment with all of this change, after a lot of isolation, with a lot of paradoxes, with a lot of polarization. What are some maybe personal rituals, some interpersonal ones, rituals at work? Have you had experiences with that that you could sort of share with the audience in terms of creating rituals?
I just want to just acknowledge Miriam and putting your commander-in-chief in check. I was listening to an Inuit indigenous elder in Canada talk about that sometimes there's more distance between our minds and our hearts than there is between us. And so if any ritual, any rituals that you can engage in as an individual or even as a company, is for integration. It's for integration. So definitely a big fan of having not just the typical company retreat, but consistent community circles, consistent restorative circles where people can just spend some time just resonating with how they're arriving. You know, I was facilitating a community circle yesterday, and I just asked a very simple question. I was like, what questions are you asking yourself right now? Period. And some of the questions that came up were fascinating in a corporate space. Fast. They were like, you know, should we move? You know, in relationship to their home, should we move homes? Should, you know, how do I become less irritable? Is this the right place for me? Hot one, you know. But it was an anonymous virtual platform that I used. But all kinds of questions that enabled the community to just kind of say, hey, you know, I think we're all on the same page here. We're all kind of hurting. We're all kind of curious. We're all kind of trying to make sense of it. And at the end, there was a deep and profound sense of community. So any ritual that allows us to just connect mind, heart, community. And lastly, gratitude rituals from an individual level. If you can get up every day and just write, you know, three things you're grateful for, that tends to really support with overall well-being in the long term.
I'll take up your first point of asking each other questions, because you put that to your group. What are the questions that you're asking each other? And I want to actually take the example of your new game, Esther's new card game, Where Should We Begin, which is basically a wonderful collection of questions that are supposed to be conversation starters. We will use them today as a way to end this conversation, but as a last way of connecting. So I would ask each one of you to take one card and then choose who you would like to ask the final question to. So each one gets one.
You don't want me to talk about ritual?
Yeah, oh, but yes, please, absolutely. No. Happy to, if you'd like to please, add please. First.
I think it's such a beautiful question, mm-hmm. and I think that the quote from Suleika Jouad is also really apt. A ritual is a routine that is infused with creativity and intention. Mm. A ritual is symbolic. Mm. A routine is a habit. Mm. A ritual adds the meaning of that habit, mm-hmm. and it becomes symbolic. It mm-hmm. represents something more than what it actually mm-hmm. is in the act itself. And this, I wrote so much about ritual, mm-hmm. routine, and boundaries this year, actually. Mm-hmm. But I started this year, and I don't think it should be limited to that, because this goes back to what you were talking about with time. Mm. There was such a collapse of time, mm. such a collapse of all our roles into one place. And we usually have speciality. I change to go to different activities, to meet different people. I change location, I change clothes, I change environment. And it creates boundaries, delineation, demarcation. When I have none of that.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
That's so beautiful.
Just in the right moment.
That is wonderful. That is wonderful.
I think that rituals are helping us create these demarcations mm-hmm. between day and night, between work day and play day, mm-hmm. between being functional and being reflective, between being alone and being in community, between mm. taking care of and being taken care of. Yeah. It's essential to actually think about rituals ever more so in a secularized society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know, more than ever, we are creating rituals because we are less receiving the legacy rituals that our culture, our community, our religious cohort handed down to us mm-hmm. for how we come into this world, for how we leave this world, for how we deal with fragility, with illness, with uncertainty, with nature. All of these things have been regulated with rituals. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I can't emphasize the importance of it enough, so thank you, Suleika.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe we will end with the ritual of
playing
asking,
cards.
Yes, playing cards or being playfulness.
Storytelling. It's the ritual of storytelling.
Exactly. Please each take one and think about who you would like to ask your questions to. Mm. And perhaps this time I'll have Esther start because we did the other round.
Though I just spoke, so I'm willing to. Do you want to go? Because I just spoke.
I'd love to ask Miriam this. I wish I had spoken up when.
I wish I had spoken up when I observed many years ago that in a period of time where there was no Me Too movement or things like that, when people transgressed my boundaries, and I thought, as often the only woman in the room in the business world, and I thought, that's not okay, and I didn't speak up, but I do now.
And is it age, maturity, confidence, or the permission that society now?
All of it together. I really think so. I think confidence grows when you grow older and you get more experience. You collect the examples where you know I can really do that. But I think the whole debate in society has really made a change, major change, and I'm very glad that this happened because I think it was really necessary.
Thank you.
So I'm the next one. I'm going to ask you, Esther.
Yeah.
Would you like to share a dream you've never shared up to now?
You know what? The dream that I've never shared up to now with me, something like that I've never said out loud, I would say is this. What I am living now is actually a dream I had as a child.
Oh.
You know, when I was a child, I used to think, and I would think, listen to the experience of my parents and what it was like to be Jews in World War II. And I remember as a kid saying, no door will be closed to me. I will enter all these spaces and they will want me there. They won't exclude me from society. They won't try to destroy me. And these were like wishes I would say to myself at night, just as I was lying in bed, like, one day, you know, they will want me. They won't hate me. That kind of thing. And I feel actually that I am living that. Mm. What I don't say is that it actually was a dream that has come true.
Mm. That is wonderful. Mm. Thanks for sharing.
You know, I've actually never said this.
Mm.
Mister, it is hard for me to admit.
It's hard for me to admit how much I need support right now. In terms of giving birth to my firstborn son with my wife and being extremely isolated during the pandemic and feeling an incredible level of isolation still.
Mm. Mm. Thank you for sharing.
What is one of the more significant experiences of support you got in this period?
My wife's mother, and Sydney, his grandmother, has just been with us almost every other day, and that's been incredible. Incredible. And she's the only, 3 months in, she has been the only family member that Sydney has interacted with extensively. Because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's major, major.
That's the wonderful side, one wonderful side
yes.
of the pandemic, that even though connection was basically difficult,
mm-hmm.
some connections
mm-hmm.
grew extremely intense. I have similar experiences,
mm-hmm.
and I'm really grateful for that.
Mm-hmm, me too.
So again, we have an ambiguity of needing support and having a sort of maybe lack of, but also having gratitude for what is there.
Mm-hmm. And striving. And flourishing and,
yes.
and having a sense of aliveness in the face of isolation, holding the paradox of isolation and desire for connection.
And so. Taking it slow
yeah.
while being playful.
Yes.
I mean, this entire conversation could be called Both And.
Mm.
Yes. That's a wonderful title.
Yes.
Mm. And I think it can also be summarized by something that you recently wrote. I think actually just yesterday you talked about the fact that we are entering the great adaptation. We need to stay grounded while the ground is moving. And I found that really moving, actually, but I really loved that. That's basically what it feels like. This ground is moving. It is so shaken up. And somehow we have to really engage in the great adaptation to find our own being grounded again.
Mm.
So thank you.
So it's so interesting because one of the images that led to this title, this is the title of a conference, my professional training conference I'm doing. And I had listened to Dr. Lisa Fortuna talk about her work in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And she was talking about how children were looking at the trees, the ones that fell because they couldn't bend,
mm.
and the ones that stood because they were able to bend.
Mm. Mm.
And I thought bending, which is somatic, which is movement,
yes.
which allows you to adapt and redress and come back in a different place, but it involves flexibility and nimbleness, that actually is part of this great adaptation. I, of course, think of it in terms of what does it mean for therapists
mm-hmm.
or for leaders or for CEOs to experience this great adaptation at this moment. And that's really what I want to explore. But the image was really bending.
Mm.
And bending, you know, if you can't bend anymore, you break things
mm-hmm.
as a person too.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a beautiful point to end on. I want to thank you all very much for joining us here today and for being in the flow with us.
Das war der ADA-Podcast, heute das Morgen verstehen. Entwickelt wird der Podcast von der gesamten Redaktion der ADA Learning GmbH. Produziert werden unsere Folgen hier in Düsseldorf bei Audioversum. Wenn ihr uns unterstützen mögt, dann gebt uns doch 5 Sterne, teilt uns auf Social Media oder lest unser Digitalmagazin unter ada-magazin.com. Mehr über die ADA Learning GmbH gibt es unter join-ada.com.
ADA. Heute das Morgen verstehen.